Testimonies from those who knew him as a young man, collected by William Herndon, repeatedly emphasized Lincoln's affinity for Shakespeare. "He nearly knew Shakespeare by heart," said one. "Mr. Lincoln read Shakespeare, Byron, Burns extensively while he lived in New Salem," said another. "You wish to know what Lincoln used to read, he read Shakespeare," said another. When Lincoln came to Washington as president, he could at last see Shakespeare's plays performed on the stage and meet actors. In 1863, an actor named James Hackett, whom he'd seen playing Falstaff, sent him a book of his own notes on Shakespeare. Lincoln delayed responding enough that he felt a little guilty, and instead of just saying thank you, added some observations that are a prime source of our knowledge about Lincoln and Shakespeare. He then made a critical observation, an example of his use of his critical faculties that I mentioned.
Executive Mansion, Washington, August 17, 1863. My dear sir, months ago I should have acknowledged the receipt of your book and accompanying kind note, and I now have to beg your pardon for not having done so. For one of my age, I have seen very little of the drama. The first presentation of Falstaff I ever saw was yours here, last winter or spring. Perhaps the best compliment I can pay is to say, as I truly can, I am very anxious to see it again. Some of Shakespeare's plays I have never read, while others I have gone over perhaps as frequently as any unprofessional reader. Among the latter are Lear, Richard III, Henry VIII, Hamlet, and especially Macbeth. I think nothing equals Macbeth. It is wonderful. Unlike you gentlemen of the profession, I think the soliloquy in Hamlet commencing, "Oh, my offense is rank," surpasses that commencing, "To be or not to be." But pardon this small attempt at criticism. I should like to hear you pronounce the opening speech of Richard III. Will you not soon visit Washington again? If you do, please call and let me make your personal acquaintance. Yours truly, A. Lincoln.
Good afternoon. Let me remind everyone that at this same hour, 5:30 on Friday afternoon of this week, Lee Edwards, who is, I believe, one of the leading scholars of the history of conservativism and conservative thought. I've known Lee for 45 years, I guess. He is at the Heritage Foundation. He was trained by William F. Buckley, Jr. We'll be here to talk about the future of conservatism after the 2008 election. And so I hope many of you will be able to come listen to this very smart, very articulate senior scholar. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Several months ago, my wife and I had a house guest who, after he returned to his house, wanted to send us a little present and sent me a copy of Lincoln's Virtues, one of the many books by William Lee Miller, with a note saying, "Have you ever heard of Bill Miller?" And I immediately sent him an email containing links to our website where several of Bill Miller's talks here were archived, and said, "I've known Bill Miller for many years and known him to be a scholar not only of Lincoln but of many other topics." After Bill Miller was educated at Yale, he served on the New Haven Board of Aldermen. He taught at Yale, he taught at Indiana University, he taught at Smith College, all before landing here at the University of Virginia. Since he's been here, he has served as a professor of religious studies, as chairman of the Department of Rhetoric and Communication Studies, as the Thomas C. Sorensen Professor of Political and Social Thought, as the Commonwealth Professor of Political and Social Thought, and most recently as the White Burkitt Miller Center Scholar in Residence. Bill has written a whole, you have to go to two pages in Amazon to get just his major books, and in addition to his many articles. The first book of his that I recall reading was after Jimmy Carter was elected president. He wrote a book explaining the phenomena of this particular Georgian winning the White House called Yankee from Georgia, The Emergence of Jimmy Carter. When I was trying to learn about the origins of the Civil War, I read his wonderful book, Arguing About Slavery, The Great Debate in the United States Congress. And most recently, I've read two of his books on Lincoln, both of which we will be selling out front, and Bill will be signing at the end of the forum. Lincoln's Virtues, an Ethical Biography, and then the more recent book, President Lincoln, The Duty of a Statesman. And for any who are interested in very accessible books about Lincoln and the issues that he confronted as president, there really are no better books. It's a great pleasure to introduce a personal friend and a deep friend of the Miller Center, William Lee Miller.
Thank you, Franklin.
Thank you, George. It's great to be here. Our topic is a slightly unusual one, Lincoln and Shakespeare. I get responses when I say that we're going to talk about that, and people look a little puzzled, but I hope we can make it clear why that is a valid topic, an interesting one. Abraham Lincoln would write in a lecture he gave in 1858 that writing and print are the greatest of inventions, and that they enable us to converse with the dead, the absent, and the unborn at all distances of time and of space. Those great inventions of writing and of print would enable William Shakespeare, writing in London in the 1590s, to converse with young Abraham Lincoln himself in the backwoods of the New World in Spencer County, Indiana, in the 1820s. That was a great moment when, by way of the printed page, Abraham Lincoln encountered William Shakespeare. To a surprising extent, this practical politician, this man of action, liked and read and recited, and himself tried to write poetry. In his youth, he loved Robert Burns. All his life, he read and recited poems of a wistful, melancholy sort. And according to his aide, John Hay, Lincoln read Shakespeare more than all other writers together. Lincoln would read Shakespeare throughout his life, very much including his time as President of the United States. As president, according to his son Robert, he carried with him a volume of Shakespeare's plays in the way that Senator Sam Ervin of Watergate fame would carry in his pocket a copy of the U.S. Constitution, and the way many a Christian soldier has carried the New Testament. What Lincoln carried with him was Shakespeare's plays. It is probable that the book in which young Lincoln first read Shakespeare was a pedagogical volume put together by a man named William Scott with the title Lessons in Elocution. That book included, for elocutionary practice, 18 soliloquies and speeches from Shakespeare's plays. If this assumption is correct, Lincoln's first meeting with Shakespeare came not by seeing plays on the stage, not by a presentation in an organized academic setting, and not by reading entire plays, but by lonely reading of soliloquies, of great passages from the tragedies and histories standing alone. Partly from this beginning, but mostly from his own nature, Lincoln's lifelong encounter with Shakespeare then would have these characteristics. First, it was altogether centered on certain tragedies and histories, not on the comedies. Second, he approached the bard less for character and story than for intellectual meat and moral illumination. Once he would even say, "It matters not to me whether Shakespeare be well or ill acted, with him the thought suffices." Third, as a young man training himself to be a writer. He absorbed the language and the rhythms of Shakespeare into his own prose. He did not quote Shakespeare often, but he borrowed words and adopted cadences. Fourth, he came to the plays not only to accept and enjoy and learn from them, but also to make judgments. Judgments of a particular presentation of the plays, judgments of the plays themselves. It is surely significant how often Abraham Lincoln, the merely unprofessional reader, as he described himself, responded to Shakespeare with his own critical opinions, perhaps at odds with the readings by some actors and others. And here we come to a central point about Lincoln throughout. He knew his own mind. He acquired, when young, an intellectual and moral self-confidence that would be the root of his great accomplishment. In the book Lincoln's Virtues, I gather a long list of activities and attitudes in the world young Lincoln lived in that he did not share or partake in. He did not like to hunt in this hunting society. He didn't like to fish. He did not swear. He did not gamble. He fled. I make a whole list of these in that book, and when you add them up, it gets to be impressive. He fled from farming as fast as his long legs would take him and headed for the state's capital city. Spiritually speaking, he was not a rail splitter. He did not despise Indians as those around him did. He did not vote as his neighbors did, join a church as his family did, believe what his neighbors did. What he did do when he could was to read and shape his own ideas. His stunning work of self-education gave him the intellectual and moral self-confidence to make his own appraisals of life and of presentations of Shakespeare. When Lincoln left home and set out on his own, coming to the little village of New Salem, he encountered an intriguing village intellectual named Jack Kelso. One who knew them said Kelso loved Shakespeare and fishing above all other things. Abe loved Shakespeare, but not fishing. Still, Kelso would draw Abe. They used to sit on the bank of the river and quote Shakespeare, criticize one another. Testimonies from those who knew him as a young man, collected by William Herndon, repeatedly emphasized Lincoln's affinity for Shakespeare. He nearly knew Shakespeare by heart, said one. Mr. Lincoln read Shakespeare, Byron, Burns extensively while he lived in New Salem, said another. You wish to know what Lincoln used to read, he read Shakespeare, said another. Mr. Lincoln commenced carrying around with him on the circuit, the judicial circuit, to the various courts, books such as Shakespeare. When Lincoln came to Washington as president, he could at last see Shakespeare's plays performed on the stage and meet actors. In 1863, an actor named James Hackett, whom he'd seen playing Falstaff, sent him a book of his own notes on Shakespeare. Lincoln delayed responding enough that he felt a little guilty, and instead of just saying thank you, added some observations that are a prime source of our knowledge about Lincoln and Shakespeare. He then made a critical observation, an example of his use of his critical faculties that I mentioned.
Executive Mansion, Washington, August 17, 1863. My dear sir, months ago I should have acknowledged the receipt of your book and accompanying kind note, and I now have to beg your pardon for not having done so. For one of my age, I have seen very little of the drama. The first presentation of Falstaff I ever saw was yours here last winter or spring. Perhaps the best compliment I can pay is to say, as I truly can, I am very anxious to see it again. Some of Shakespeare's plays I have never read, while others I have gone over perhaps as frequently as any unprofessional reader. Among the latter are Lear, Richard III, Henry VIII, Hamlet, and especially Macbeth. I think nothing equals Macbeth. It is wonderful. Unlike you gentlemen of the profession, I think the soliloquy in Hamlet commencing, "Oh, my offense is rank," surpasses that commencing to be or not to be. But pardon this small attempt at criticism. I should like to hear you pronounce the opening speech of Richard III. Will you not soon visit Washington again? If you do, please call and let me make your personal acquaintance. Yours truly, A. Lincoln.
Lincoln may have reached the judgment he just expressed about the two passages in Hamlet very early. William Scott's Lessons in Elocution included among its several selections from Shakespeare these two speeches side by side. Number 11, Soliloquy of Hamlet's Uncle on the Murder of His Brother, and number 12, Soliloquy of Hamlet on Death, which does turn out to be or not to be. It's true that if one reads the two Shakespeare monologues one after another, with Lincoln as one's guide, one does discover a considerable deepening, moving from Hamlet's most famous soliloquy to Claudius's tormented effort to pray, after Hamlet's play has caught his conscience by reenacting his own crime. The Hamlet soliloquy is a speculative stroll about through the questions of life versus death, tangled with the issue of action versus inaction, all of it within the frame of the speaker's own advantage, whether 'tis better this way or 'tis better that way, whether to put up with the catalog of ills in this life, all these fardels and bangs and spurns and grunts and sweats, all that insolence, or to take arms against them and by opposing end them, by suicide or by action that would be suicidal in effect. But then maybe there would be dreams, something spooky. There's the rub, and so never mind. But where Hamlet has rumination and doubt and indecision, Claudius has personal anguish and tortured certainty. Where Hamlet is puzzling over whether he should act, Claudius has already acted and knows without doubt that what he did is not just wrong, but smells to heaven. Claudius, in his monologue, knows that while he is not willing to give up the effects of his crime, he cannot be pardoned, not in the highest court. He knows that although his offense itself might in the corrupted currents of this world provide him with the gilded hand that could shove justice around and buy out the law, that won't work with the divine justice that no shuffling can snooker. A higher justice sees and knows and makes the miscreant himself truly attest to what he has done. The dimension above, in which all is known truly, must be part of the reason, in Lincoln's view, this speech is the superior one. Another is that Claudius's soliloquy more clearly shows the inside of a tortured mind at work. Hamlet's speech may seem to be a bit more of an external academic exercise. In Claudius's speech, and again in Macbeth, Lincoln praises the accurate touch of nature in Shakespeare's presentation. We know that Lincoln could recite that soliloquy of Claudius, could act it out, in fact, from memory, effectively, because the painter Francis Carpenter, who spent 6 months in the White House working on his painting of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, heard him do so and reported about it in his book, 6 Months at the White House. Talking about Hamlet, Lincoln said there is one passage of the play which is very apt to be slurred over by the actor or omitted altogether, which seems to me the choicest part of the play. It is the soliloquy of the king after the murder. It always struck me as one of the finest touches of nature in the world. Imagine Lincoln with Carpenter and a friend listening, presenting Claudius's self-tormenting soliloquy.
Oh, my offense is rank. It smells to heaven. It hath the primal eldest curse upon it, a brother's murder. Break and I not, though inclination be as sharp as will. My stronger guilt defeats my strong intent, and like a man to double business bound, I stand in pause, where I shall first begin and both neglect. What if this cursed hand were thicker than itself with brother's blood, is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow? Whereto serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense? And what's in prayer but this twofold force, to be forestalled ere we come to fall, or pardoned being down? Then I'll look up. My fault is past. But what form of prayer can serve my term? Forgive me my foul murder? That cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder, my crown, mine own ambition, and my queen. May one be pardoned and retain the offense. In the corrupted currents of this world, offense's gilded hand may shove by justice, and oft 'tis seen the wicked prize itself buys out the law. But 'tis not so above. There is no shuffling. There the action lies in his true nature, and we ourselves compelled, even to the teeth and forehead of our faults, to give in evidence. What then? What rests? Try what repentance can. What can it not? Yet can it when one cannot repent? O wretched state! O bosom black as death! O limed soul that, struggling to be free, art more engaged! My words fly up, my thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go.
This was the Lincoln who, in his second inaugural, would see the whole sweep of the mighty scourge of war judged from above, where there is no shuffling, where the action lies in its true nature under the judgment of an Almighty who has his own purposes. Hackett, who was clearly an energetic self-promoter, made the bad mistake of having the private letter from the President of the United States printed as a broadside. He gave it the heading, "A Letter from President Lincoln to Mr. Hackett," and added, obviously with a guilty conscience, "Printed not for publication, but for private distribution only, and its convenient perusal by personal friends." But of course it fell into the hands of hostile journalists and editorial writers, and of course they proceeded to write scornful lines, sneering at the pretensions of this uneducated president, who now set himself up as a literary critic, making judgments about soliloquies in Shakespeare. Hackett was embarrassed, as well he should have been, and wrote Lincoln something of an apology. Lincoln, in his response, this time marked private, produced a generous letter containing a beautifully balanced sentence about the ridicule he had experienced, a sentence remarkable not only for its literary grace and balance, but also for its impressively calm humility.
Private. James H. Hackett, Executive Mansion, Washington, November 2nd, 1863. My dear sir, yours of October 22nd is received, as also was in due course that of October 3rd. I look forward with pleasure to the fulfillment of the promise of a visit made in the former. Give yourself no uneasiness on the subject mentioned in that of the 22nd. My note to you I certainly did not expect to see in print, yet I have not been much shocked by the newspaper comments upon it. Those comments constitute a fair specimen of what has occurred to me through life. I have endured a great deal of ridicule without much malice, and have received a great deal of kindness not free from ridicule. I am used to it. Yours truly, A. Lincoln.
In that long conversation about Shakespeare recorded by Francis Carpenter, Lincoln, in another of his independent critical judgments, insisted that the opening speech in Richard III was often entirely misapprehended. It is quite common, Carpenter quotes Lincoln saying, for an actor to come upon the stage and in a sophomoric style to begin with a flourish. Carpenter uses the word sophomoric. One wonders whether in the mid-19th century, a backwoodsman, Lincoln, would use that word. Carpenter says he did. Carpenter then quotes the first four lines of the speech as though Lincoln were reciting them in the chipper, clueless, unmenacing way with the sophomoric flourishes that he was deprecating.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried.
Lincoln said to Carpenter, "Now this is all wrong. Richard, you remember, had been and was then plotting the destruction of his brothers to make room for himself. Outwardly, the most loyal to the newly crowned king, secretly he could scarcely contain his impatience at the obstacles still in the way of his own elevation. He appears upon the stage just after the crowning of Edward, burning with repressed hate and jealousy. The prologue is the utterance of the most intense bitterness and satire." After making his criticism of the way the prologue is sophomorically misread, Lincoln then, unconsciously assuming the character, gave the speech again from memory, rendering it, wrote Carpenter, with a degree of force and power that made it seem like a new creation to me. Though familiar with the passage from Boyd, I can truly say that never until that moment had I fully appreciated its spirit. Lincoln reciting the lines would present the raw Richard with his own signature theme, the bitter, colorfully self-justifying and humorously imaginative descriptions of his physical deformity that made women flee and dogs bark. One wishes one might have been present to hear this on Wednesday, March 2nd, 1864, when Abraham Lincoln himself rudely stamped, gave Richard's opening speech the way he thought it should be given.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barded steeds to fight the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasings of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for such sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak and piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time unless to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on my own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days.
Carpenter wrote, "I could not refrain from laying down my palette and brushes and applauding heartily upon his conclusion, saying at the same time, half in earnest, that I was not sure but he'd made a mistake in the choice of profession, considerably, as you may imagine, to Lincoln's amusement. A New York friend of Carpenter's who was there with him that evening told him he'd never before heard these passages of Shakespeare rendered with more effect by the most famous of modern actors. Although President Lincoln seized the chance, now that he was in a bigger city with theaters, to see every play he could, what he most loved to do was to read Shakespeare to a few listeners, often his secretaries, John Nicolay and John Hay. John Hay gave a slightly different list of his favorite plays. He wrote, "The plays he most affected were Hamlet, Macbeth, and the series of histories. Among the latter, he never tired of Richard II. Hay wrote, "The terrible outburst of grief and despair into which Richard falls in the third act had a peculiar fascination for him. We heard him read it in Springfield, at the White House, and at the Soldiers' Home." Hay, in his reminiscence, then quotes the entire passage of Richard sitting upon the ground and telling sad stories of the death of kings. And we can imagine the secretaries hearing President Lincoln present it in three different places.
"For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell the sad stories of the death of kings. How some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court, and there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little seat, to monarchize, be feared, and kill with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about his life were brass impregnable. And, humored thus, comes at the last, and with a little pin, bores through his castle wall, and farewell, king."
Lincoln, the humorist, loved Falstaff, but otherwise, the plays that he read and quoted almost all dealt with human beings in positions of great power. Shakespeare's histories dealt by convention and necessity with the Henrys and the Richards of the English throne. Almost all the tragedies also featured some royal ruling figure at or near the center of the story: kings, princes, Roman dictators, Caesar and Mark Antony, generals commanding armies, Othello, Coriolanus. Shakespeare was not going to write that attention must be paid to the traveling salesman, Willie Loman. But in almost every case, the power brings not satisfaction, but misery, guilt about the way the power has been achieved, anxiety about maintaining it, the torment of misusing it. Macbeth achieves the crown he sought and then envies the king he killed to get it. Claudius knows the way he achieved his crown smells to heaven, and also knows he cannot be forgiven while retaining what he gained from his deed. Hamlet knows what he ought to do but can't do it. Julius Caesar is the story of a conspiracy to kill the title figure. Richard III has a kind of perverse relish in his villainy, but in the end he's going to cry, "My kingdom for a horse," and be killed. King Lear makes one of the most spectacularly foolish uses of royal power in all of literature. In all these plays, having, seeking, getting, holding power brings tribulation. They are not happy stories about what it means to be a head of state. Richard II is deposed within the play itself and muses ruefully on the sad stories of the death of kings, how the antic satirist Death looks mockingly at the strutting kings as they are monarchizing, scaring everybody with kingly looks, puffing themselves up, but then Death comes at the last with a little pin, bores through his castle wall, and farewell, king. But there's one king in the Shakespearean canon who was indeed a happy warrior. One major play in which the glory of ruling is the central thread, Henry V. That play features the Band of Brothers' exuberance about the war with France and its glorious victory at Agincourt. But Lincoln never mentions that play. Why not? I suggest because it is loaded with a triumphalism, a, a tribal egotism, an unabashed aggression that even as he led the nation in the mighty scourge of war, Lincoln scrupulously avoided and disavowed. It was the swaggering George McClellan, and not his commander, who would quote to his men the language of King Henry before Agincourt. The war Lincoln led was a necessity, a scourge, a test for all the world, whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. It was not a glorious, self-aggrandizing adventure. There's a thread of interpretation put forward now by a tidy list of scholars that holds that Lincoln's preference for guilt-ridden monarchs, for Claudius's rumination in Hamlet, for bloody-handed, sleep-deprived Macbeth, sprang from or reflected his own feelings of responsibility, if not guilt, for the horrendous suffering of the war, for his own bloody hands, for his own insomnia of power. Maybe there is some truth in that. One should remember that Lincoln liked these plays before he ever thought he would himself be a head of state. I believe it is correct, Don Fehrenbacher wrote in the best presentation of this theme, there's no substantial evidence that Lincoln suffered from a sustained sense of guilt, either real or neurotic. But then Fehrenbacher adds, yet at times his responsibility as president must have weighed as heavily as the guilt of any assassin, and the latest casualty lists may have seemed like accusations. What he himself said about Shakespeare's plays was that they profoundly represented what life is like. Carpenter quoted his having said about Claudius's monologue, "It always struck me as one of the finest touches of nature in the world." For Lincoln, Shakespeare presented life with a dimension of depth that he found profoundly true. On the last trip on the River Queen, returning on the Potomac from the front on April 6, 1865, Lincoln kept reciting Shakespeare, particularly Macbeth. A listener reported that now and then he paused to expatiate on how exact a picture Shakespeare here gives of a murderer's mind when the dark deed achieved, its perpetrator already envies his victim's calm sleep. In Act 3, Scene 2 of Macbeth, Lady Macbeth chides her husband for his sorry fancies about what is done. She says, "Things without all remedy should be without regard. What's done is done." Macbeth replies,
"We have scotched the snake, not killed it. She'll close and be herself, whilst our poor malice remains in danger of her former tooth. But let the frame of things disjoint, both the world suffer, ere we will eat our meal and in fear and sleep in the affliction of these terrible dreams that shake us nightly. Better be with the dead, whom we, to gain our peace, have sent to peace, then on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst, nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further."
That was on Sunday, April 9th. 2 days later, in a speech on Tuesday, April 11th, discussing a proposed Louisiana Constitution, President Lincoln said he hoped that elective franchise would be conferred on the very intelligent Negroes and those who serve our cause as soldiers. The actor John Wilkes Booth had already been shocked by the sight in Richmond a week earlier of newly freed slaves ecstatically welcoming the visiting president. Now Booth, who was in the audience listening to this presidential speech, said, "That means nigger citizenship. That is the last speech he will ever make." 3 days later, on April 14th, as the president was sitting with his wife in a box in the dress circle in Ford's Theater, Booth opened the door of the state box drew his derringer, shot Lincoln behind his left ear, leaped from the box the 11 feet to the stage, caught his foot in the drape, broke a bone in his leg, perhaps shouted Sic Semper Tyrannis, and fled out the back door of the theater to his waiting horse. Booth, a member of a family of distinguished actors, had appeared in many of Shakespeare's plays and thought his deed might be regarded as that of Brutus, the brave removal of a tyrant. But that is not how it would be regarded. On the contrary, the new telegraph and cable carried the terrible news almost instantly around the world, and the world responded with an outpouring of shock and of grief. I discovered as I came to the end of writing President Lincoln that the State Department had gathered an immense collection of the condolences that flooded into the embassies and consulates all around the world. And I ended the book with a selection from that deeply moving collection. Nicolay and Hay wrote that although it usually takes time for the elite to decide that a hero is to be celebrated, in the case of Lincoln, the many imposed their opinion all at once. He was canonized as he lay on his bier by the irresistible decree of countless millions. The greater part of the aristocracy thought little of him, but the burst of grief from the people silenced in an instant every discordant voice. Those who had been with him on the River Queen that last Sunday would remember him reciting Macbeth.
After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further.
Our understanding both of Shakespeare and of Lincoln has been greatly enhanced by the assistance of the fine Shakespearean actor Alex Grubbs. Alex is a graduate student in the drama department, and we're very grateful to our friend Bob Chapel of the drama department faculty for putting us in touch with Alex. Alex, thank you very much. Bill Miller has indicated his willingness to answer a few questions, and I would like to ask those who would like to ask questions to please join me in the back of the room. Bill, to sort of kick it off, you have written about the great crises that Lincoln faced and the great ethical issues he faced. He wanted to save the Union because he felt that if there was secession, it wouldn't just be a number of states falling off, the whole Union would dissolve. He did not want to fire the first shot in what he knew would be a civil war. And he also had the terrible dilemma of what to do about slavery. His life, in many respects, was of Shakespearean proportions. Do we know whether or not he ever explicitly framed his life in comparison with the Shakespearean plays? Did he ever say, "I feel like a character in a Shakespearean drama"?
And not that I know, not that he said it. Let me tell you the story of this event. This is not my idea. This is the idea of the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. Some person within that had the idea of Lincoln and Shakespeare, and asked me and a Shakespeare scholar and a theater scholar to do it, to join in doing an evening that will discuss this with actors from the Shakespeare Theater in Washington. And we got together once and talked about it and shaped it out. And it turns out it's going to be this. When I tell you the place and the date, this will give you the heebie-jeebies. It's going to be presented on April 13th in Ford's Theater. And I'm told it's already sold out, which makes me a little nervous. It was their idea to do this, and we worked it out, and actors would participate with part of it. And the first thing, now I get around to answer George, sort of. The first thing I did as I started to think about this was to write the story of Lincoln's own life as a Shakespearean tragedy. You can certainly do it, and you started to do it, George. I don't know that Lincoln ever did that.
The story of Lincoln's self-education is quite remarkable. You mentioned Byron and Burns as other literary influences in his life. Were there others that we know of?
Other influences on Lincoln? Well, the great influences were, reading those books there in the backwoods of Indiana that he could get his hold on. I propose the notion of a benign deprivation, that there wasn't all the trash that you're surrounded by today, and the things that made their way there were good. The King James Bible, of course, he knew and knew well, could quote, make references to, draw things from. And then he read the American founding documents, and identified with those. Those and Shakespeare and Burns, he read Byron some too. That's about the list as far as I know of. And he had these poems that he read that he particularly liked, that he would recite. He wasn't, although in his New Salem days, when he's in his early 20s, they would say he read every book he could get his hands on. That's not true later. Later, Herndon says he rarely read a book through. He read intensely. The way you can see, he kept reading Shakespeare. He read things with depth rather than trying to read widely.
Well, thank you for this fascinating presentation.
Did it work?
Yes, it worked really well. It's really terrific. My name's Phyllis Kotsharis, and I'm a writer and an actress and so forth, and I'm just so struck by thinking about what are the cadences, what are the particular rhythms and even the words that you mentioned that Lincoln took from Shakespeare, and I wonder, put into the Gettysburg Address or some of these, if you've been able to identify those and we can...
That's a terrific question. I won't do justice to it. I've got some things here I can... bring in one thing that occurs to me. You notice as Alex read the word shuffling from Shakespeare, that appears then in a Lincoln speech that I should be able to nail down, but Lincoln then uses it. One of these current good books about Lincoln, a book about Lincoln as a writer, parallels. Let's see if I can get this right. He takes Falstaff's one of the two or three famous Falstaff speeches that banish Jack, how does that go? These Shakespearean scholars, he's got a series about banishing Jack, and they put that over against a series that Lincoln did. It said a totally different subject. He does the same kind of rhythm. He doesn't quote Lincoln, he doesn't quote Shakespeare very often. Occasionally he does. One of the interesting times he does is in a court case, he quotes from Othello, my purse is trash, stealing my name is really steal something, makes a difference. You can quote it better than I can, I'm sure. In a case in which the lawyer for a couple of miners who owed a man for the use of his oxen claimed they didn't have to pay because they were miners and they weren't bound by a contract. And Lincoln argued for the man who was owed the money, and he made it that you don't want to destroy these boys' reputation by having him win this case. So in other words, he used the Othello quotation to do that. Well, maybe I'll remember some of the other quotations. There aren't a whole lot. He rather ungallantly referred to Mary Owen, the woman he sort of had a beginnings of an affair with, and she really turned him down, said he didn't have attend to the little things that matter to a man. And he, in a letter he often wrote to older married women, said, well, she'd be a good match for Falstaff. She'd got, apparently gained weight.
Thank you. We recently read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, A Team of Rivals. And in that book,
you are
she...
not alone.
No, no, it's wonderful. In that book, she calls Lincoln our only poet president. And hearing your talk tonight makes me wonder, did he ever write poems? His speeches are quite poetic in their prose, but did he ever write poems? And if so, why have I not read them? And were they suppressed because they simply weren't worthy?
He did write. He did try when he was young to write, early adulthood. They aren't very good, but they're interesting that he tried. And some books you can find these. He wrote a poem about going back when he first went back to Spencer County, Indiana, and there was a boy, Matthew, there who lost his mind. He wrote a poem, tried to incorporate that. He made some efforts at writing poetry at that stage of his life, but then later he was preoccupied with other things. He wrote, as your question implies, his writing of his speeches was a work of intense concentration, getting ideas and getting phrases and writing them on scraps of paper and then gathering the scraps of paper, putting them together and making his speech.
Bill, that's really has been a fantastic presentation that you've given, along with your colleague who read so well about Lincoln and from Lincoln and from Shakespeare. What I wanted to mention, though, was the irony of the entire situation of his death. And you touched on it a few moments ago. And the fact that with this background that he had in Shakespeare and that Shakespeare had with him, that it's so ironic. Here he was in a theater listening to our country cousin, not to Shakespeare that particular night, but probably an amusing story. How ironic do you feel about that?
Well, you've said it all. When it draws back from making wisecracks about his going to the theater once too often and whether Mrs. Lincoln liked the play and so forth, all that. It's really a terrible moment in American history. When Ken Burns made his thing and he stopped his crew and said, now we're in this moment when Lincoln gets shot. And it's a big, a major loss in American history.
Thank you for a wonderful talk and a wonderful presentation that shows us so much in much greater dimension about Abraham Lincoln. The fact that he didn't like the comedies or the sonnets apparently is interesting to me.
Didn't like the
comedies. Is that correct?
I infer that that's true. In the letter to Hackett that Alex read, he said, some of them I have never read, and I hear in that sort of, and I'm never going to read. And I think if he got a copy that had Widder's Tale and As You Like It and so forth, he would not read those. He would be reading. The only comedy he would read was The Merry Wives of Windsor because it had Falstaff in it. He did like Falstaff, but no, it was the certain of the histories and the tragedies that he focused on.
Well, that really answers my question. I wondered if he had ever commented or made any mention of any of those, and maybe did he consider them sophomoric or...
I don't know. Other than that sentence, that's the only clue, and the fact that he never quotes any of them, any of the comedies, and I think he probably, as I already imply, he never read them. He liked Falstaff. I mean, it's not that he didn't like humor. He loved the character Falstaff, who appears, of course, in the two parts of Henry IV. He is a character in histories rather than in the comedies.
Bill Miller is the author of Lincoln's Virtues and the author of President Lincoln, The Duty of a Statesman. And both will be available, and Bill will be willing to sign copies following the forum. Please join me in thanking Alex Grubbs and William Lee Miller.